I'm your number one fan. There is nothing to worry about.
You're gonna be just fine. I'll take good care of you. I'm your number one fan.
Called reading. Top to bottom, left to right. Group words together as a sentence. Take Tylenol for any headaches. Might offer any cramps.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Lit Faced, the companion podcast to the Midnight Society Book Club. I am Danny Trioxin, and I am joined today by Dr. Dark. What's up, Dr. Dark?
Nothing much. I was getting ready to cut in and say who I am.
Well, see, that's why I went ahead and sped up, because learning from the Midnight Horror Show, I know if I don't hurry up and prompt you, you will just cut in. So I had to jump all over that real quickly, trying to take a step in the right direction. So
I was worried that you were going to say this was the companion podcast to the Midnight Horror Show, and I was like, oh no.
You know how many times I've almost done that trying to prep for this, like I was going to say that, but you know, it's good now. We're all taken care of. We didn't do that, so that's good.
We're getting the bugs out of the way now before the big launch of the book club in January.
Exactly.
This is our soft opening.
And this is the first time we've actually not rushed into something and screwed it all up royally. We've actually given ourselves two preseason books, if you will, for November and December, so we can kick it off January the right way. Like you said, work out all the bugs. We're trying to find a good way to get feedback on the books by posting a small 5 simple question survey. So we can kind of get a cumulative score, a feel for the book. We want you guys to, send us your discussion points, discuss it on the Facebook group, which we'll give out that information later on. But we want you guys to engage and discuss this book. If anyone wants to come on and do this show with us, we are more than happy to have you on here for a roundtable. Now, we know some of you are going to be uncomfortable with that. So if you want to send them to us in an audio file, or if you just want to fill out the form, and we'll discuss, we'll make sure your comments get discussed. And if you don't want to be mentioned, you don't have to put your name. We won't mention you. So however you want to do it, we just want you guys to engage and let's just have fun for the next year with discussing some cool books. Maybe you'll find some new authors that you weren't reading before, and maybe a favorite book here or there. That's my ultimate goal. Dr. Dark, what is your goal out of all this?
My goal is to do just what you said and not make people feel uncomfortable, not say anything too revolting and vulgar. I promise if you send us comments that you don't want associated with you, I won't look up your street address from whatever information I have and tell people your real name and where you work, like I used to do with the, the K7 voicemail, the Yahoo voicemails back in the day when someone would send a shitty comment in.
Yeah, maybe this disclaimer was a really bad idea. We might lose like everybody that's reading books right off the bat with you talking. Of course, he hasn't done that in years, so I think you scared everyone. Don't say that. You haven't done that in years.
I haven't done it in years. I've gotten much lazier in my old age.
What's funny is off the shows now, this is behind the curtain for some of the ones that do listen to the Midnight Horror Show and found us that way. From that show, you would think that Dr. Dark is definitely the most immature of all of the hosts. What's funny is, in reality, he actually is probably far more mature than any of us. Maybe not Duncan or Brett, but you are definitely more mature than the rest of us. But you just don't show it on the show.
I doubt that I am. I'm really not, but, I could fake it either way. I could go either way. I could be the most mature and upstanding person anyone has ever seen, but I find that boring, so I, like to make a lot of dirty jokes and say a lot of inappropriate things and things that would lead people to think that, you know, my brain is that of a 12-year-old.
Well, sometimes it is. It, like you said, you can turn it on and you can turn it off. So
hopefully when we do our other DUI podcast or PUI, podcasting under the influence, or driving under podcasting, or whatever we could call it, if we are recording from the car, you edit it well and take out some of the crazy stuff that we just say.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, hopefully this will be, you know, we'll still use the Midnight Horror Show from time to time when we can all get together more as a roundtable show. It's not going to be anything that we do constantly anymore. We just can't keep up with that. But it is a neat show to return to almost on a reunion basis, have a couple drinks on a weekend and throw down an episode. It's a good way for all the other podcasters that are part of the group that do their own shows to come and kick back and not have a formula and not have any organization to it and be able to say whatever they want. And none of that was actually planned. I know that sounds like we planned it that way. That's just because we were so lazy. So we figured just morph the show into what it already is. And so that's what we use the Midnight Horror Show. Here, we would like to discuss these books.
It's our outlet.
Yeah, it's our dirty little outlet. This one, though, we'd like to have good book discussions. Now, of course, the vulgarity and some of the silliness won't go away because that's just who we are. But we do hope to be more focused on the books, the novels, and the novel discussions, as opposed to the Midnight Horror Show that very rarely touches on horror, even though it's called the Midnight Horror Show. But this one is called Lit Faced, which is Dr. Dark combining two things he loves in life, drinking and getting shit-faced, and reading. So neat, Dr. Dark. I like that.
Rarely at the same time, though, because I've had enough trouble like remembering details and things like that. So, you know, I've sat down and read books when I was drunk before, and it was great fun. I really enjoyed it a lot. And then the next day I'm like, I don't remember anything I read. I'm going to have to go back through that again.
Yeah, that's, I have that happen even when I'm not drinking. It's hard. It's really hard, to sit down and, take some time in the afternoon to read a book after work or something. The first thing I want to do is pass out as soon as I open the book, and it has nothing to do with the author or what's written. It's just, it's been a long draining day. And I think that's why I drifted into the Audible and audiobooks.com category of doing audiobooks. And they've kind of become an obsession of mine. I know you might feel the same way. I know you definitely are rolling through a lot of these books in audio. And a lot of the books that we're not doing on the book club, we've done through audio. And I don't know about you, but it's become a very big addiction and obsession to me to do books this way.
Well, if you remember, I was a holdout on that for a long time. I was a complete hard copy book snob that, you know, didn't think it really counted to do it that way. But as my life became more complicated, so that I really haven't got any time to sit down and actually open a book, I became more open to it. And I got to say, like the book we're reading right now in December, I read, actually I didn't read it in hard copy. I did it on the Kindle, which is, you know, kind of similar to having a book. I consider it the same as reading in print. It's not the same as, like, you know, holding the book in your hand and all that stuff, but it's pretty much the same. But listening to it now is, you know, five times better, at least for me. And, you know, I've come to really enjoy listening to the books on Audible, not to give them too much, you know, free press. But
yeah, no, I agree. It's
some free press. Hopefully it'll come back around.
Yeah, you know, everything comes back around. But you know, everyone, you know, nowadays is, you've got really busy schedules. There's so many things that take up our time nowadays with devices and social media and everything else. So it's nice to be in the car on a drive, you know, just doing tedious work at home or at the job if you can. And just slipping in some headphones and just kind of drifting away into a book. So, you know, some people like the podcast format so they can get real quick driven stories. And I like that too. So some people don't really like to do this long, you know, 17, 18 hours of the same story. But, you know, give it a try because there's a lot more of these professional narrators that are really selling the story. Like Dr. Dark says, the book we're doing in December is a great book, in my opinion. Of course, we don't want to get into that yet. We're not in December, but I do feel and agree with him that it is made even the better by the narration of Kate Mulgrew. So, yeah, and that I'm looking forward to that. So that's why we're knocking this one out.
I can't, I can't wait. Yeah, we're knocking this one out so we can start recording little snippets about that, and I can gush about that. It's taking everything I have not to right now.
It really is. And now some of the, you know, sometimes the audio version isn't going to be the way we can all go. Now, I do recommend that for some of these books because we are trying to squeeze out 12 books, 12 months, a book a month. Some of these books are going to be really easy to knock out in a month, like Coraline by Neil Gaiman. Some of the other ones are going to be a little bit bigger. And you might have to drift into the audio world for that. Now, you don't have to go full audio if you don't want to. There's places that offer stuff like Amazon's Whisper Sync, where you can sync it up to your Kindle version, and then when you stop reading, the audiobook picks up. When you hit pause on the audiobook, your digital copy of the book will pick up where you left off there. So there are ways that you can do both sides of this. But, you know, like a book in January, our very first book, House of Leaves, there is no audiobook for that. I hear that's because of the way the book is written, which is very interesting to me. And that's why we, you know, chose that to be the first book. But yeah, some of these books, there are not going to be an audio version for. So we're just going to have to get in the trenches and push through it.
Thing is, you know, if you think about it, reading a book a month is a pretty good pace for the average person. I mean, I think it is anyway. And if you're buying like a book a month, if you're buying a new hardcover book, I mean, you're looking at like $25. So for an Audible credit, you know, that's not that much. It's not as much. And you still get your book in. And for some of the shorter books, you know, it might be cheaper and easier for you to actually buy a print copy and read it. But, you know, you have options.
Yeah, I kind of feel like Duncan. Most of you know Duncan. If you don't, he hosts over there at Podcast Under the Stairs, as with many other podcasts. He's also on the Midnight Horror Show with us.
The podcast Under the Stairs at all.
Well, yeah. And he's and he'll be on here with us. He's going to be a part of the book club as well, going to be drilling through some of these books with us. So he'll be on here with us. But I look at it the way he does. You know, there's certain movies that we'll talk about in digital format. And if they're good enough, you know, just like you said, you got to have the physical copy. He'll go out and he'll buy the physical copies. He buys the Blu-ray special editions, the nice casing, all the wonderful goodies that come with it. I feel the same way about a book. I might do the Audible version and love the book so much that it's got to go on my shelf. You know, I'm going to have to buy that thing and put it on my shelf.
That's exactly what I do. Like I think I read 40 pages of the book that we're doing this month, Sleeping Beauties, in print. And I was like, God, I'll never, ever get through this book at this rate of, you know, 40 pages every, you know, once a week or something. So I went to the audio version. And, you know, there's a lot of cases like that where, you know, I might enjoy the book and want to put a copy on my shelf just to have. And I might not even go back and open it, but I just like having it because I'm a book hoarder.
It's our generation, man. I'm telling you, our generation and back. Maybe the newer generations won't feel the same way, but it's, you know, we had our VHS shelves, our bookshelves. We're just used to like displaying our wares like we're in an Animal Crossing game or something. We want everyone to see what we own, and you can't do that in digital. So, yeah, I feel like some of these books, I don't know if all of them for the next year I'm going to put on my shelf, but looking at some of them, reading the synopsis, I'm pretty sure the majority of these are going to go on my shelf. A lot of these sound like really good books, but we'll see. We'll see when we get to them. Sleeping Beauties, you know, the one we're doing right now, by Stephen King and his son Owen King. I was sure this would go on my shelf. Not so sure. Well, let's get into that. Let's go ahead and get into Sleeping Beauty, shall we? I think we've gotten enough of the initial out of the way. We told people, you know, if you want to be on the show, where to go. If you want to join the group, it's Facebook
groups.
You don't
have to read a book. We told you for 10 minutes, two different ways you can do it.
Exactly. There's ways that you can do this. There's ways that you can do this and not have to really slice away some of that precious time in your day to sit down and actually just read and ignore everyone. I mean, everyone's got to drive, right? I mean, none of us are the Jetsons. Some of us might have like a 3-minute drive. Most of us have at least a half an hour drive, and you can, you know, pop out a little bit of the novel, you know, washing dishes, doing that, mowing the, well, no one's mowing the lawn now. It's December. What the hell am I talking about? But there are tasks that you can do.
Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, really. Not here though. Not
maybe
here on the East Coast.
Mowing the leaves up.
Yeah, that's about what I'm mowing, is just shredding leaves, but no grass to mow. But anyways, you know, there are tasks that you can do to enjoy these Audible books and to help, you know, keep up the pace. Now, of course, if you don't finish these things in a month, not going to kick you out of the club. We're not going to berate you. We're not going to put you in the town square and let everyone see that you're the one that didn't finish the book. Because, you know, that we can't even put out shows on time for you guys on our old show. So we know how it goes.
If you fake it, I mean, how many times did I fake that I actually watched a movie on the other show?
Absolutely. We're not here. We're not a book club that's going to berate you if you don't stay up. If you skip a couple months, you know, we understand. But, you know, if you are reading the book, you know, discuss it with us. Let's engage. Let's talk about these things, because a lot of us go off to our workplaces and a book like, you know, The Hellbound Heart or maybe Peter Klein's 14, there's not a lot of people at work we can talk to about these things. So that's another reason we created this group. So like-minded individuals that enjoy these dark novels can all come together and we can all bitch about them or praise them. So and there's going to be a little bit of that on both ends here, I think, today. So let's go ahead and let's get started with our first book, our preseason book for the book club, November's book, Sleeping Beauties by Stephen King and Owen King. And I almost said Owen Wilson again, which is what I said in the pre-show, the pre-recording I did to get this feed up. I almost called him Owen Wilson again. And I don't know why I keep doing that. Maybe it's because I feel that Owen Wilson actually wrote this. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if Stephen King and Owen Wilson could coexist or not.
Yeah, I don't think
so. I think he probably has a pretty good sense of humor, but I don't know if he could be around someone like that all the time to write a book.
Owen? Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if any of us could be around Owen Wilson that long. I mean, he's a great guy, I'm sure, but I don't know. To write a book, that's a long time to be sitting around with someone.
Yeah.
All right, so let's give you the synopsis real quick. This is the synopsis straight from Wikipedia. So then we can sit down and discuss this as well. The way the show will go, we'll give you the synopsis. We're going to tell you what did work, what didn't work, overall thoughts, things that we had a problem with, anything like that, and then give you our final score as well as let you know what the group has decided as its cumulative score. So, of course, this one we don't have as many results because we literally threw this thing up today just to get this book done so we can move on. Now, once we get to January, we'll be, you know, way more engaged with you guys with getting this stuff out on time. All right, so here's the synopsis. The novel follows Clint and Lila Norcross, a husband and wife who live in the impoverished Appalachian town of Dooling, West Virginia. Clint works as a psychiatrist at the local women's prison, while Lila serves as the town's sheriff. The two find themselves facing an epidemic that causes women to fall into a deep sleep where they are cocooned in a strange material. Attempts to open the cocoon and wake the women only result in them reacting in a homicidal manner. As a result, the remaining women try desperately to remain awake by any means necessary, while some men react by trying to set fire to the cocoons or accusing women of bringing the sickness upon themselves. One woman, Evie, seems to be the key to the entire bizarre affair. You think it's a fair synopsis, you think? Or is it giving too much?
It does give a lot. Especially that last sentence.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
Yet, even though reading the book, you know that she seems to be the key to the bizarre affair, you still don't know exactly why she's the key to it or anything like that. I mean, yeah, spoiler alert. You're not going to get everything answered at the end of this book, folks.
No, not at all. We're going to try to, we'll try to tip you off before we do any major spoilers to this thing. But we figure it's the end of the month, you know.
That's like an anti-spoiler because, you know, I'm telling you that, you know, you're not find everything that you might want to know out.
Yeah, if you're interested in reading this book and you have not finished it, just stop the cast now and come back later because there are going to be things that we might slip up and not be able to warn you that we're going to be spoilers. So just figure from here on out, this is spoiler territory. So if you have any desire to keep reading this book, just don't listen from here on out. If you're not or you're done with it, continue on, my friends, continue on. All right, so let's start with what did work about this book. Dr. Dark, what worked for you about this book?
I think being as mysterious as the whole situation with all the women starting to fall asleep and all that is, the fact that they did set it in, you know, rural Appalachia's poverty-stricken coal belt of, you know, Dooling, West Virginia, kind of tucks things away and lets it really get a strong start before the rest of the world kind of finds out about what's going on, you know, since that's the epicenter of it from that point. So I think that's one thing that worked about it. I think that, you know, in general, a lot of the characters were good. Stephen King is pretty good at getting you interested in the characters and getting you to feel some buy-in into them and, you know, what happens to them. So I think in general that worked. There were a few that, you know, maybe you could have done without, or maybe you care a little less about. But in general, I think that was a strong part of the book.
I would agree, just because there are, I mean, there's no lie, like 70 characters in this book. And they list these characters out right in the beginning of this novel. There is an appendix in the beginning that is basically the entire list of characters, and it's about 70 of them. So right off the bat, this is a little overwhelming to me. But I would
I didn't bother to read that. I mean, like you mentioned that part at the beginning, it tells you all about the town and who these people are and what these places are, and, you know, kind of lays out the whole thing. And I'm like, dude, this is a small town in West Virginia. I mean, I don't need to read this. I grew up in one of those, but not in West Virginia. You don't have to tell me about, you know, the little town and all these people.
I mean, that's all that filler they give you at the beginning, that they're prepping me for something, actually, like, intimidates me before I go into a novel. But I will say that with 70 characters, they handled most of these with a really professional touch, which, I mean, of course, is Stephen King. Owen is what? He's got one book out, Double Feature, which was a fairly good book a couple years ago. Not horror by any means. But they do a really good job of, you know, they give us all the stereotypes. You know, we've got the abused, and of course, most of it focuses up at the women's prison in Dueling. So, you know, we've got the drug abuser, we've got the murderers, the child murderers, the, you know, it's basically like a really dark episode of Orange is the New Black going on up there. But I do feel that they handle all the characters really well, even by making them like complete stereotypes. You know, you've got the touchy-feely cop, you know, the prison warden. And you know, so you get a lot of these stereotypes, but I feel like they handle them very well for having so many that you have to try to keep up with. And you said that, you know, of course, this book doesn't really come to a understanding at the end where everything's explained. And in that same token, I feel that not all the loose ends were tied up. But to have that many characters, I do feel like they did most of them justice in trying to tie those up.
Yeah, it's really just one, and you know, and that's Evie. I mean, she's the one that you don't know exactly what she is, where she came from, what she's connected to, if she started this or if she's just a piece of something, or what the deal is with that, unless I really missed something.
No, I mean, that's accurate. I would say something else that really worked for me with this book is Stephen King's ability to handle the beginnings of an apocalyptic event or an epidemic. He did it with The Stand. He even did it with a book like Cell that I'm not a big fan of, but I do enjoy the setup. I feel the setup for this disease was on par with Joe Hill's The Fireman, Stephen King's The Stand.
I mean, I even think he did a good job setting up that type of stuff with Under the Dome.
Oh, absolutely. You know, absolutely.
What it actually was, you know, that stopped me from reading the book when you told me what it was.
Yeah, when I spoiled that one for you. It's funny that you mention Under the Dome, though, because I feel like this book, and of course this will drift more into the negative, so I won't say too much about that, but it feels like we're under a dome again with Dueling West Virginia. You know what I mean? Like, I'll touch more on that on the things that didn't work, but it's funny that you mentioned Under the Dome because I keep seeing that quite often when I'm reading through this book. Like I said, I'll touch on that in a second. Anything else that really, really worked, for you in this book?
I mean, I think the, you know, the connections between people, we talked about the characters, but the connections, with, you know, like the 6 degrees of separation in a small town kind of thing, was really effective in terms of how the characters are drawn and how they're related to each other throughout, you know, their different roles in the town.
I would say that they do very good at connecting all those little lines with this one doing this, and then it connects to this guy who knows this guy who went to school with this guy, and that's very fitting for a town like Dueling, West Virginia. I think the stereotypes were played up right, like I said before, and even more so with the townsfolk, just like the prison. You know, you had your, I can't remember the crazy old coot's name with his little corncob pipe, and the volunteer police officer guy. I can't think of what his name was now, out of the 70 characters. But I did enjoy him. I enjoyed the setup of the town. And that's all I can say for all the good. If you're done with the good, I'm ready to go into what's wrong with this book.
Sure, go for it.
All right, let's do what's wrong with this book. What's wrong with this book is about everything that we just didn't list and what was right with this book. This thing starts off so strong. Like I said, he's great at describing these post-apocalyptic events, and it feels that once the event reaches the climax, everyone's rushing around, the women are falling into these cocoons. Once the sun comes up the next day and the dust has kind of settled, I feel that the novel itself kind of settled. It just drops off from there. There is nothing. There are parts that entertain me and keep me invested in it somewhat. But I really can't tell you any, obviously, other than the huge event that happens in the end. I hate to even call it huge. That's such an exaggeration. But other than that event, I don't really remember a lot of milestones that take place after the initial surge of the Aurora flu.
Yeah, there really weren't, you know, which might say something in and of itself about, you know, a world that's mostly devoid of like all the feminine sentiments and things like that, when it's just a bunch of pig-headed men running around doing things. And, you know, they're mostly worried about, you know, where they're going to stick something at some point.
Do you feel that's a little overplayed and ridiculous, though, that every man in this town, for the most part, turns completely Neanderthal when the women start going down, except for, coincidentally, our main character, who just happens to be the embodiment of everything that's right with men and can analyze and understand I just felt like that was really ridiculous. I mean, he seems to be the only one that can figure out.
He's in West Virginia, so he can't really, you know, and his wife's the sheriff, he can't really come out. So,
well, I just feel that I'm not even playing into that one. I'm just not even playing into that one. I just feel that he's the only one that realizes there's anything going on with Evie. And I find this is saying something about people in dueling West Virginia. I mean, the chick is like half naked half the times. She's got green pubic hair. Okay. And now that might be normal in New York, Miami, Los Angeles. Dueling West Virginia, they are going to burn her at the stake for having this green pubic hair. This chick is completely crazy and no one believes it but Clint. I just find that ridiculous. Like, I think his own son even questions whether he should trust in his dad with this whole, you know, craziness about Evie and protecting her for a couple more days. And I don't know. I just feel that Clint was over the top with that.
Off. And the whole thing where, you know, we first meet her where she's like bashing the meth lab trailer apart and putting people's heads through walls and stuff. And then, you know, she calmly gets naked into the back of the police car and then on the way starts to like bash her head open on the, you know, on the barrier in between the two. But then she kind of just goes into her cell. It's like this chick has issues. Like, bad.
Yeah, and then she sits there and she's like, well, just protect me for a certain amount of days or whatever. And it just feels like some giant game is being played, you know, with the entire world's population. Yet the most important part of this is taking place in dueling West Virginia. And that's what I meant by under the dome. I feel like we, you know, they kind of touch on this airplane that went down and something that happened in London and this and that. But you don't ever really get a feel for a global scale of this. It feels very isolated to the town of Dueling, West Virginia. And they never really tell us what was so important about this place or why these women are the ones that had to make the decision, spoilers, sorry, about coming back from what they called our town. And I just don't understand how this can be on a global scale. I almost feel like if they would have just kept this to it affected just the town of Dueling, West Virginia. Of course, you would have to write in and figure out how to fill all the loopholes with, you know, isolating yourself from the outside world, trying to step in and help or cover, you know, this information and spread it all over the internet, whatever. That would be difficult. But it just feels like it's kind of silly to think that this is on a global level, but Dueling, West Virginia is the deciding factor on whether this happens or doesn't happen.
Yeah, that's one of the things that was really something that Stephen King doesn't usually do. He usually fleshes out his little inscape worlds and things, like, to the point where all the T's are crossed and I's are dotted. But, you know, well, there was that tree behind the meth lab that was the key to coming in and out of our place, the town on the other side. But, you know, it leaves open the question of, you know, where are all the other women that have gone into their cocoons in the rest of the world? Are they in their own little place that mirrors the town that they live in? Or, you know...
Well, no, because it was just our town. Our town was the only one that...
Well, that's the only one we heard about. But it you never find out. Like you said, you don't hear more about what's going on in the rest of the world. So you never know... like, where were all the other women that had gone into cocoons in the rest of the world?
See, I felt like it led us to believe that our town was, like, the epicenter of this whole thing. So even if these women were going off to their own worlds, we never touched on them to show that that was happening. And that would have been a good way to clear up the loophole that... So, spoiler again, we know that these women, when they're burned in their cocoons in the real world, that they disappear and vanish from our town, the other world. So was this happening with other women across the world too? I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, did they just go to a limbo? Did they, I don't remember. Were they coming to our town? I don't think so. I feel like it was a really, really good idea. And it's just, it didn't flesh itself out properly at all. And of course we haven't even mentioned yet the big ending, the conclusion to this Lord of the Flies esque grand battle, you know, for basically, you know, male supremacy over the, you know, I don't know what you want to call Clint in this situation, but he was like the voice of reason versus all the, you know, the Neanderthals. And they staged this huge battle. I mean, it's at the prison grounds. There's sniper rifles getting involved. It feels like this is the whole last half of the book, gathering up the supplies to get ready for this invasion on the prison, and the prison getting ready with their limited supplies to fend off this attack. This attack kicks in, and we literally goes nowhere. I mean, I'm not kidding you when I say that these things, the guns are drawn, there's blood on the ground, there's bullets flying, and the simplest of actions in this book is almost like blowing the whistle for Adult Swim and the kids get out of the pool. I mean, it is done. I feel like that was really flat for me. It's really left a really horrible taste in my mouth.
Yeah, it kind of makes me wonder, you know, what happened. Like, I don't understand how the same person that can create the Dark Tower series and draw it out for like 3 decades over 7 books can feel like this is complete. But I don't know, maybe he doesn't.
I don't know. Lately, he's done stuff like Revival, which kind of left everything very humdrum at the end of the book, but you felt that it was complete.
It was a complete story. Absolutely. And it was very dark, and it left you, you know, feeling like you wanted to slit your wrist. But, not really, because you didn't want to,
you didn't want to die, yeah. I mean,
yeah, you want to become an ant.
But see, by the end of that book, you feel something. You're like, you know, this is a scary thought to think that, you know, that you don't want to die. You know what I mean? Like, and it's funny because he takes both angles on this. He did it with the Green Mile with Paul, who was touched by, you remember, John Coffey. So he begs for death because he watches everyone else around him die. With Revival, the guy begs to have that eternal life because he knows what comes in the afterlife. So these things make you think about that kind of stuff. After Sleeping Beauties, there's nothing really to think about, you know, other than, you know, what the hell was Evie? Who was controlling Evie? Who's Evie's boss? You know, and who's making these rules up? Like, who made these silly rules up that if you hold off till Tuesday, if the women unanimously vote, then everything can go back to normal? Like, who made these silly rules? And why does everything have to wrap up so nicely in this book? You know, and it sounds horrible to say because it doesn't really wrap up nicely, but they try to give you a happy ending, which I feel that it shouldn't be that way all the way across. I don't know if I feel these women should have come back. I don't know if I truly believe that everything would have just fallen into its perfect little piece in place like it did in this book. And the talking animals, We cannot do this without talking about the fact that there are talking animals in this book.
Yeah. Yeah. This, I don't know. This has got to be Owen's influence, I would think, because I've never known Stephen King to have an animal talk in a book.
I mean, we had The Dark Tower, like you mentioned, is a huge fantasy series, an epic fantasy story. It has Oi, the weird dog badger type thing, you know, that everyone loves. And Oi can barely say, he says, ache, ache, and Oi. He doesn't even really speak. And now this, you know, this fox and this rat and this lion and peacock, I mean, these guys could sit down and have a tea party together. They have, like, they speak so eloquently. The fox is, I don't know. At the time, I was okay with it. I was like, well, this is interesting. But then at the end of the book, I was like, well, that was stupid. It didn't serve any purpose to me. And I worry.
Well, I mean, the only thing I got out of it was it shows the kind of like interconnection between like Evie as a Mother Nature type, you know, character and how what she was doing and what she was involved with was connected to nature and the animals and all that. But
true. I just feel that it could have been done in a
snake and, you know, all that stuff.
Well, you know, in a book that we're already talking about that feels like you didn't finish it and you spent a lot of time filling. We could have probably cut out, you know, the deer or the fox and the rat making a deal with each other that really doesn't affect anything down the line majorly. Or the fact that one of the biggest things going on during this apocalyptic event is a problem in the Norcross household between Lila thinking that Clint is cheating, and this whole thing stretches out. And then when we finally get to the conclusion, it really has little bearing on the story itself. It has effect on the characters emotionally and where they will progress from, you know, the events of the novel.
Yeah.
But I feel that we do not need to know that information. And that is not something I would concern myself with as the world is falling apart. I think it's silly.
Yeah. And there's a lot of talk about how much she didn't really want the swimming pool.
Yeah. And I do really feel that the ending of her shooting, you know, shooting the African-American girl and, you know, feeling like, would she have given a white? I feel like that was kind of shoehorned in. I feel like that was unnecessary.
Yeah.
And it's almost counterproductive from what you have shown us that, I don't know. It just, they go one way with how they want us to feel, you know, destructive men, you know, constructive women in our town and destructive men in the real world. Well, then she basically has a moment that I would have felt would have been better off with one of the officers or something. I just feel like it was shoehorned in there and kind of unnecessary.
Yeah, I agree that was shoehorned in. The other thing, though, it's an interesting paradox that the men could do nothing to make the women come back. So as much control, you know, if you want to call this sort of like a critique of, you know, like misogynistic culture and say that that's something no one ever thought Dr. Dark would be saying.
Really, really.
If you want to say that that's what this book is doing, pointing out, you know, those types of elements, the fact that there's nothing the men could actually do to make the women come back. If they tried to open the cocoons, they went into, you know, crazy mode and started killing and maiming, and there was nothing they could do to make them come back. The women had to decide on their own to come back, and the only thing the men could do was destroy them by either burning them or, you know, whatever, or harming Evie to the point that, you know, whatever it was would happen that they couldn't come back. That was never really made clear exactly what would happen if something happened to her and, you know, the portal would close, that they couldn't come back through the tree. But yeah, I don't know. I'm rambling now.
No, I feel you. There's a lot of things I feel that if you were already going to push this book to the 370 some pages that it is, I mean, Stephen King, you've never shied away from making, you know, huge tomes of literature before. So take some time and flesh this
out. I think you would have even had to go, like, you wouldn't have to go to the length of it that was like 1,400 pages or
something.
No, absolutely
not.
If you went another 250 on this one, I think you could have really fleshed out a lot of things and made a lot more things make sense to where it would have been a little bit more. Even if the ending turned out completely the same, I think by explaining a little bit more of backstory and you know, what the good versus evil, or you know, man versus woman, or whatever the situation was that was playing out. If you'd explain a little bit more about that, people would have felt a little bit more satisfied with the ending.
Yeah, I agree. I and some people, you know, the thing is, I enjoyed this novel. When I finished it up, I was like, all right, that was an enjoyable read. It was only after I had to sit down and really start thinking about more and more, I was like, you know what? I don't know if I felt how I felt about that, and why didn't they explain that? And oh, that's kind of silly. So someone out there might really enjoy this novel. So, you know, and I usually always find enjoyment in Stephen King novels. And, you know, I will still tell you that
I'm not sorry I read it.
No, I enjoyed reading it. I'm glad I read it. It's not something I'd ever revisit, and I don't really feel that I need to put it on my shelf. You know, it's not one of those books to me. But someone out there might really enjoy this book. I just don't give it too much thought afterwards. I almost feel like a lot was put into this book, and someone's probably going to pick apart all these little, the peacock, the symbol, the this, the that, and try to connect everything like Stephen King, you know, so eloquently does with all of his other work, Back to the Dark Tower. And I think they're going to be going down some, what was that game that we used to play where we tell someone to go find the creature that doesn't exist?
Snipe hunting.
I feel like they're going to be on a snipe hunt. I feel like a lot of these are going to be dead ends that don't really connect back around. I feel that this book could have almost been written as a B horror novel where we didn't have to have all this social commentary on the way things are nowadays. And,
there's a lot of jabs at old Donald Trump.
Yeah, I feel that if we could have just started opening the women in the cocoons and they started coming back as crazy rabid zombies. Yeah, we've been here, done that 100 times before. I almost feel that that would have been more enjoyable. Take out all that, you know, all that topical beef that you tried to put in this thing. I really feel that it didn't go where I think they wanted it to go. I see where they were going, and they probably could have pulled it off very well. They just didn't. They just didn't stick the landing this time. And it happens sometimes. You know, I think it's so shocking because it feels like it's been a while since Stephen King has on a book. You know, lately we've been like,
you count Gwendy's Button Box. That was horrible.
Well,
but
yeah, that's true.
I think he struggles. You know, Stephen King is, if you just look at some of his books, I mean, people kind of write him off as, you know, a goofy horror author. But I mean, as far as I'm concerned, his books are as much literature with character development and plot and settings and things as any book that anyone else would ever call literature in like the span of writing. But if he's writing with someone, like when he wrote with, Peter Benchley, who has a lot of other, you know, big novels on his own, by his own right, who's an accomplished author of his own right, they did okay. I did say the right person, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
okay. Yeah. I was worried there.
Wait,
for a second.
No, you didn't. Hold on. No, you didn't. You said Peter Benchley. We mean Peter Straub.
Peter Straub. Wrong Peter.
Yeah, I was like, wait a minute. No, we're talking about...
I got my Peters confused.
Is it Benchley Jaws or Psycho? Wait. Yeah okay. Okay, yeah. I was like, holy shit, no, that's not him. You're talking about Peter Straub. Yeah, the Talisman and the Dark House the Black House.
Yeah. So, you see, folks, nothing's really changed in terms of how we get things mixed up. But we have good intentions. The two of them wrote fairly well together. I guess it's kind of different to, you know, I never worked real well with my dad. We had too much similarities in some ways, too much differences in some ways, and it just didn't mesh well. You know, I think that Owen brought some of the fresh points of culture and literature and things and modernized some of, you know, Stephen's thought process in some of his writing that turned out really well. But in general, I'm not sure that they just meshed real well together, and maybe that was why he was trying to rush it to a conclusion. Who knows? You know, the same thing with, I honestly don't think, other than talking about Derry a little bit, or Castle Rock, sorry, I don't think Stephen King had much at all to do with Gwendy's Button Box, because that was horrible for me.
Which is kind of scary, because I think we're doing a Cheesemar novel next December.
Yeah, and his might be okay on their own. I don't know. I've never read one of his books, but I don't think he has a ton out, does he?
Richard Cheesemar has, I mean, not a ton. I wouldn't call it a ton. We're not talking Koontz or anything, I don't think. But, you know, it's not a novel. It's not an author that I've really, honestly, I've not really paid any attention to Richard until Gwendy's Button Box. So this is a
and
new one for me.
A lot of his were through Cemetery Dance, right?
Yeah, I think so.
A smaller publisher.
Yeah, that's. I think that is where most of those come from.
Yeah.
But, you know, like you said, it could be entirely different when he writes on his own. You know, we know, like you said, that we know that they can collaborate and do pull it off well. He's done it with Joe Hill, his other son. I think it's just Owen might be in a different category when it comes to writing. I almost feel like if Owen and Tabitha maybe sat down and did something together, maybe,
yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like Stephen
Absolutely.
Feels like yeah. Joe, they just play off each other so much better.
Yeah. I mean, you know that in a lot of his books, he's mentioned that Tabitha read it for him or this and that. He's given her credit for that. But the two of them would, you know, have never sat down and tried to write a book together that we know about.
Yeah. Not that we know of. They might have, but I'm not aware of it if that's the case.
Right.
All right. So what's your final review on this thing? Or what's your rating? So let's do the way let's just go through the questions like we have them set up for our listeners when they do the five simple questions on the survey. So the first question, print, audio, or both? What did you do? You did both, actually.
I mean, I did a little bit of both, but I mean, you can barely count what I did in print. So, yeah.
Okay, I did audio too. I didn't do any of the print, and I almost feel, you know, of course you didn't do enough of the print, but I feel that you would have had a lot more difficult of a time trying to get through this thing had you just done the print and not had the narrator at least trying to sell you 70 of these characters with his, you know, a little bit of voice differentiation there between them.
I don't know. I think I probably would have just breezed right through it and kind of glossed over some of the characters and been done with it and be like, huh, okay.
True. That's true. I thought that's true. All right. So will you read other works by this author in the future? I mean, that's it's no question. Of course, we're going to read Stephen King. And the people that filled out the survey so far all are in agreement. Funny thing is, everyone did the audio version of this book, did fill out the survey. And they all agree, of course, it's Stephen King, that they're going to read him again in the future. Now, the next question is, where on the horror scale would you classify this novel? The scale is a 1 to 10, or 0 and 1 being, you know, small horror elements, and then the top 10 being right up there with the scariest novels that you've ever read. Where would you put this?
I'd probably put it in the middle somewhere. I mean, there was a lot of catastrophic stuff going on. You didn't really have a good sense of the scale of it, you know. But I mean, it was certainly a big catastrophic event going on. But it definitely was more easily resolved than most. So yeah, I'd put it like right in the middle of like a five.
All right. I feel that the horror died in this novel for me after the first lady comes out of the cocoon and she killed people and was crazy. And we never, ever, ever return to that element anymore in the book. I'm going to go with where everyone else actually went, right at number two. They went at a two. The horror is so thin in this book. Now, of course, if it would have stayed the course of the first half of the book, I mean, this would have been right up there.
What you require to call something horror. I mean, if you require a lot of blood and guts and gore, there's very little of that. You know, if you think about like a catastrophic apocalyptic occurrence as being horrific, you know, then yeah, it's kind of like the age old debate we've had on the show about Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah. All right. So I do feel that apocalyptic events are horror. And maybe it's because I'm male and this didn't seem like this could affect me falling asleep. And the fact that we get to the end and know that as long as we just wait it out and play by the rules, everything goes back to normal. Very few are actually harmed by the Aurora virus itself. Most of them are hurt by their senseless violence that they start getting into because of the epidemic. So yes, it can be scary in terms of something like Swan Song. I feel that the way they paint the apocalypse is terrifying to me. Not so much on this one for me. It's it's interesting,
yeah,
but it's not scary to me because even before we
got to
this.
And I think if it had drawn out a little bit longer, it may have even raised up a little bit, because you have to think, if this goes on, you know, humankind has only got so much time.
Yeah, wouldn't it have been neat instead of, you know, we get the whole setup with this and the initial night of it, and then we almost like fast forward like 2 or 3 years in the future. Like, I really think that novel would have intrigued me more to know, like, to see how it all started and now to be in the future. And, you know, now things have gotten really bad and, you know, and found a maybe a different way to get the women back instead of some silly, you know, oh, we've all learned our lesson. Yes, we did. Okay, women, raise your hands. Do you want to come back to the men? Okay, this is all, you know, I don't. All right, so yeah, so you say 5. Most everyone else says 2. Between 2 and 5, I completely agree. I think that's good common ground right there. Questions, comments, statements, favorite parts, quotes, discussion points, etc. Kind of left it wide open for anyone. We've pretty much discussed everything we had to say. We did have a reader in the group say that they feel like it went off the rails halfway through this book. And I think both of us, me and you, are in agreement on this, right? We feel that that's about where this thing kind of tanks.
Yeah, it definitely, you know, it started to peter out before it really got to the actual climax near the end.
Yeah, when you get to the climax at the end, I feel like you just want that to hurry up and go on, because you want to know if there is a resolution. I think that's the only reason I kept going through this, because I just wanted to see how it was all going to end. I didn't really care. There's very few characters that I actually care about in this book, and my favorite character from this book was one of the worst people in this book, and it's more so that the narrator just gave her such a great voice, and I can't even remember what that character's name was now. The crazy one.
Oh, yeah. I can't remember either.
Can't think of her name now. It's gone right out of my head. Okay. Which says a lot about the characters, too, because I can remember, you know, random characters from all of Stephen King's books down to stuff like Dinky Earnshaw. You know, these random side characters that have very little story, but I can't seem to remember her name. And that goes with a lot of these characters in this book, aside from Clint. I can't even remember Clint and Lila's son now. Don't even remember his name. He was one of the main characters, too. Yeah. Don't even remember. All right, so the overall ranking for the book. On a scale of 1 to 5 stars, where are you putting this?
As much as it hurts me to do this, I'm probably going to stay right in the middle of the road and say like a 3.
I said a 3 as well. We had some for 3, but the majority that filled out the survey went with a 2, giving this book a 2.3 out of 5. For its weighted average score. That's probably the lowest I think I've given a Stephen King book since Cell, which was another apocalyptic book that started off with a huge rush and then slowed down and got to an ending that you weren't really satisfied. So yeah, it feels like it belongs there with a 2.3. So for those that did the audio version, which luckily everyone that filled out this form did the audio version, the audio narrator, where does that now put it? With the audio narrator for you, any difference?
I think the narrator did a good job of differentiating characters and, you know, just overall keeping the pace of the story going. I mean, I was satisfied with the narrator.
I was too. Most people went middle of the road here with a 3. Which is good, because if we were given the book an overall 2, it at least jumped a star because of the narrator. So the narrator did, in this fact, add to this novel, giving that a weighted average of 2.6. So yeah, a much better score with the narrator involved. So if you are going to do this book and you haven't done it yet and you've already listened to our spoilers and you've already listened to us talk about the rating of it all, do the Audible version. If you're going to do it at all, do the Audible version. I can't think of what her name is, but she does a really excellent job with the narration of this book. God, I cannot remember her name. She's not one of the, you know, my Mount Rushmore of narrators that I can always remember.
Yeah.
And of course, now I've drawn a blank on all of those too to name those off to, but whatever. All right, so that's where Sleeping Beauty falls here at the Midnight Society Book Club. We have left it with a 2.3 as the overall rating, and with the audio narrator, it's a 2.6. All right, so we hope you enjoyed the book. Or didn't, but you enjoyed it enough to return for this month's book. We are doing a seasonal book for December. It is the third of the King family here. We are doing Joe Hill's Nosferatu. And for those doing the audio version, that is read by Kate Mulgrew, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. So yeah, we're post memes, post questions, post whatever you want in the Facebook group. It is Midnight Society Book Club. Come join it up. Post it over there. If you know anyone that reads books and wants to get down with this book reading challenge, share it with them. Let them know. Get them to join up. We're ready for everyone and all to join us and read these books with us. We're looking forward to it. I enjoyed this. You know, I enjoyed sitting down and actually talking about this book. I enjoyed that we actually did something that we said we were going to do. There's a lot of enjoyment going on over here, and a lot of it is because we did something.
Yeah, now we've got to get it posted so someone else hears it.
Yeah, that'll be the final step.
Finally, over the hurdle of
we will of
our projects that normally stays on the cutting room floor.
Absolutely. So I feel happy that this is going to move on. I'm looking forward to talking with all of you about these books. This is going to be really fun, I think. We got a lot of really good books.
I can't wait to hear what other people say about some of these books.
I really can't wait to see what everyone says about this book. You know, if any more comes in the feed, I'm really looking forward to December's
review. Yeah, me too.
January's, I'm looking forward to 14. I really want to see what people think about Peter Klein's 14.
Yeah,
a lot of good books. And if you see one that you know of that you want to recommend for 2019's reading list, let us know, because we know we have a new Stephen King coming out next year, The Outsider. That'll probably go on that list. So if you see any books you want to go on this list, add them to the list. That was it. And you know, if you're not into the reading, I don't know why you're even here listening, but if you have stumbled over this and you don't like the reading, just wait around a little while, because someone already bought the rights to Sleeping Beauties, and I'm sure it'll be a TV show or a movie. I don't know if it'll last past the first season, if it ends up being a TV show. But it has been licensed out. Someone bought it. I can't even remember who the company was, but someone has the rights to Sleeping Beauties. And with King nailing up all over the place, I'm sure in the next 2 years you will see some adaptation of Sleeping Beauties.
The other thing, if you find some short stories that you would like to recommend, feel free to let us know about those too, and we'll let everyone else in the group know about them. We can always shoehorn some short stories into our discussion.
And we're all about doing some extra credit. I can't remember what the book was now, because I haven't looked at the list here lately, but I know we're doing a Clive Barker book at some point. So, you know, someone finishes that up early and you want to do a little extra, you know, there's The Hellbound Heart, the novella that Hellraiser's based on. Very short, nice little extracurricular stuff to do. Let us know that you've done it. Post, come to the group, let us know books you're reading, even if it's not, you know, these books, it's there mostly for us to discuss these books as they go on, but it's for anything going on in horror literature or literature in general. Just let us know what you're doing. Let us know what you're reading. So that's going to be it for this week. We're out of here. You can hit us up, like we said, over at the Facebook group. Email us. For right now, you can just email us at DannyTrioxin@gmail.com or MidnightHorrorShow@yahoo.com. We'll accept it either way there. You can find this on iTunes. Give us a review. Share it around. Enjoy your reading. Nosferatu, everybody. Let's get it started. We're out of here. Goodbye, Dr. Dark.